to the concrete. He would have killed him for sure, but the sound of approaching sirens made him pause and look up. In that moment, Billy kicked, scrambled to his feet, and ran up the driveway of the nearest house. He climbed into a car parked in the driveway. Dave chased him. Billy slammed the door and locked it just as Dave landed on the windshield. He slid over the surface of the hood, peering into the interior. Billy aimed his gun, but he was too shaken, too terrified to fire. Dave dropped down to the passenger side, tried the door, yanking again and again at the handle. Billy was gasping for breath, watching him. Then Dave dropped down again, completely out of sight. The sirens came closer. Billy realized his predicament slowly. The police were coming. He was locked in the car with a gun in his hand, his blood and fingerprints smeared all over it, powder marks and a red cut where the hammer had nipped him. He didn't know how to shoot, not really. He had just wanted to scare them, is all. The police were going to find him here, trapped in this car. Cautiously, he peered out the passenger window, trying to see Dave. Black and screaming, Dave leapt up and slammed against the window. Billy screamed and jumped back. The gun fired, hitting the dashboard, plastic splinters cutting into his arm, the car filling with smoke. He dropped the gun onto the floorboard, leaned back in the seat. He was gasping for breath. Sirens, closer. Maybe they would find him here, but it was self-defense. That would be obvious. Monkey Boy was a vicious animal. The police would take one look at him and realize that everything Billy had done was self-defense. He had to protect himself. The monkey kid was vicious. He looked like an ape and he acted like an ape. He was a killer. He belonged behind bars in a zoo. Flashing red lights sweeping the roof of the car. The sirens stopped. Billy heard a bullhorn. "This is the police. Come out of the car, now. Very slow, with your hands where we can see them."
"I can't," he yelled. "He's out there."
"Come out of the car, now," the voice boomed. "With your hands up."
Billy waited a while, then came out, holding his hands high, blinking in the bright spotlight of the police cars. A cop came up and shoved him onto the ground. He snapped handcuffs on him.
"It wasn't my fault," he said, his face pushed in the grass. "It was that kid Dave. He's under the car."
"There's nobody under the car, son," the cop said, lifting him to his feet. "Just you, nobody else. Now, you going to tell us what this is about?" His father came. Billy knew he was going to get a beating, but his father didn't give any indication of that. He asked to see the gun. He asked Billy where the bullets were. Billy said he was shooting at a vicious kid who was attacking him. Billy's father just nodded, his face bland, but he said he would follow the cops down to the station when they took Billy there to book him. Henry said, "I think we have to admit it just isn't working."
"What do you mean?"
Lynn said, running her fingers through Dave's hair.
"This isn't Dave's fault. You said so yourself."
"I know, but there seems to be trouble all the time, biting, fighting, now gunshots, for God's sake. He's endangering all of us."
"But it's not his fault, Henry."
"I'm worried about what will happen next."
"You could have thought of that earlier,"
she said, in a sudden burst of anger.
"Like 4 years ago, when you decided to do your experiment. Because now it's a little too late to be having regrets, don't you think? He's our responsibility, and he's staying with us.
But
we're his family."
"They were shooting at Jamie."
"Jamie's all right."
"But shooting? It was some crazy kid.
Sixth grader. The police have him."
"Lynn, you're not listening."
She glared at him. "What do you think? That you can quietly get rid of him? Like a petri dish that didn't turn out right? You can't just dump Dave in the bio trash. You're the one who's not listening. Dave is a living, thinking, sentient being, and you made him. You are the reason why he exists on this earth. You don't have the right to abandon him just because he's inconvenient or has trouble at school. She paused to catch her breath. She was very angry. Anyway, I'm not giving him up, she said, and I don't want to talk about it anymore. But not now, Henry.
Henry knew that tone. He shrugged and left.
Thank you, Dave said, bending his head so she could run her fingers through the fur on his neck. Thank you, Mum.
Alex took her son to an In-N-Out drive-in, and they had burgers and fries and strawberry shakes. It was now dark outside. She thought of calling Lynn again, but Lynn had sounded harried. She decided not to. She paid for the burgers in cash. Then they drove to a Walston's drugstore, one of those block-long places that had everything. She bought Jamie some underwear and a change of clothes. She did the same for herself. She bought a couple of toothbrushes and toothpaste. She was heading toward the checkout when she saw the guns for sale over by the cameras and watches. She went to look. Over the years, she had gone to shooting ranges with her father. She could handle a gun. She told Jamie to go look at the toy aisle, and she went to the gun rack.
Help you?
It was a wimpy guy with a mustache.
I'd like to see that Mossberg double action.
She nodded to the wall.
That's our Model 590, 12-gauge, perfect for home defense. Got a special price this week only.
She hefted it. Okay, I'll take it.
I'll need an ID and a deposit to hold it.
No, she said. I mean, I'll buy it now.
Sorry, ma'am. 10-day waiting period in California.
She handed the gun back.
I'll think it over, she said.
She returned to Jamie, bought the Spider-Man toy he was playing with, and walked out to the parking lot. A man was standing at the back of her car, bending over the license plate, writing the number down. He was an older guy in some kind of uniform. He looked like a security guard from the store. She thought, run, leave now. But that didn't make sense. She needed a car. It was time to think fast. She told Jamie to get in the car, and she walked to the back.
You know, he's a damn liar, she said.
Who's that? The guard said.
My ex-husband. He pretends like this car is his, but it isn't. He's just harassing me. I got a court order to stop him, and I got a big judgment against the security guard at Walmart.
How's that?
He said. Don't act dumb, she said. I know you got a call from him. He pretends to be an attorney. He pretends to be a bail bondsman or a court agent, and he wants you to check if my car is in the lot. He says it's some pending legal matter.
Well, yes.
He's lying, and you're now liable. Did he tell you I was an attorney?
No, he just...
Well, I am, and you're an accessory to his breaking the court order. That makes you liable to damages, invasion of privacy, and harassment. She took a pad from her purse. Now, your name is...
She squinted at the name tag, began to write.
I don't want any trouble, ma'am.
Then give me that sheet of paper you wrote my license on and back off, she said. And when my husband calls again, you damn well tell him you never set eyes on me, or I'll see you in court. And I promise you, you'll be lucky if all you lose is your job.
He nodded, gave her the paper. His hands were shaking. She got in the car and drove off. As she pulled out of the parking lot, she thought, maybe it will work. Then again, maybe not.
Mostly she was stunned by how fast this bounty hunter had located her. He no doubt had followed her own car north for a couple of hours, and then realized that she had switched cars with her assistant. He and his cohorts knew her assistant's name, and they got her car registration, so now they knew the car Alex was driving. Then Alex had used her credit card, and within minutes, the bounty hunter had known about it and fixed her position at a motel in San Juan Capistrano. Realizing that she'd need supplies, the hunter had probably called every convenience store within a 5-mile radius of the motel and gave a story to the security people. Be on the lookout for a white Toyota, license so-and-so. And this guy found her right away. Unless she missed her bet, the bounty hunter was on his way to Capistrano right now. If he was driving, he would be there in 3 hours. But if he had access to a helicopter, he might be here already. Already? Mom, can I watch TV when we go back to the motel? Sure, honey. But of course, they weren't going back to the motel. She parked around the corner from the motel. From her position, she could see the lobby and the kid inside. He was talking on the phone, looking around as he did so. She turned on her regular cell phone and dialed the motel. The kid put the other line on hold and picked up.
Best Western.
Yes, this is Mrs. Coulson. I checked in earlier.
Yes, Mrs. Coulson.
It seemed to excite him. He looked around in all directions now, frantic.
You put me in room 204.
Yes.
I think there's someone in my room.
Mrs. Coulson, I can't imagine.
I want you to come here and open the door for me.
If it's anybody, it's probably the maid.
I think it's a man.
Oh, no, it couldn't be.
Come here and open the door. Or do I have to call the police?
No, I'm sure. I'll be right there.
Thank you.
He switched to the other line, spoke quickly, and then left the lobby, running down toward the rooms at the back. Alex got out of her car and sprinted across the street to the lobby. She moved in quickly, stepped behind the counter, picked up the shotgun, and walked out again. It was a sawed-off 12-gauge Remington. Not her first choice, but it would do for now. She'd get shells later. She got back in the car.
What's the gun for?
Jamie said.
Just in case, she said.
She drove off, turning on to Camino Real. Through her rear-view mirror, she saw the kid coming back into the lobby, looking puzzled.
I want to watch TV, Jamie said.
Not tonight, she said. Tonight we are going to have an adventure.
What kind of adventure?
You'll see. She drove east, away from the lights, and into the darkness of the mountains. Stan Milgram was lost in endless darkness. The road ahead was a strip of light, but on each side he could see no signs of life at all. Nothing except pitch-black desert landscape stretching away into the distance. To the north he could just detect the ridge of the mountains, a faint line of black against black, but nothing else. No lights, no towns, no houses, nothing. It had been that way for an hour. Where the hell was he? From the back seat, the bird gave a piercing shriek. Stan jumped. The sound made his eardrums ache. If you ever plan to motor west, he thought, don't take a damn bird on the highway. That's the best. He'd put cloth over the cage hours ago, but the cloth didn't shut the bird up anymore. From St. Louis down through Missouri and on to Gallup, New Mexico, all the way the bird would not shut up. Stan checked into a Gallup motel, and at around midnight the bird began to scream, ear-splitting shrieks. There was nothing to do but check out, with all the other motel guests yelling at him, and start driving again. The bird was silent once they were driving. But he pulled off the road for a few hours during the day to sleep, and later, when he stopped at Flagstaff, Arizona,
The bird began to scream again. It started before he even checked into the motel. He kept driving, Winona, Kingman, Barstow, heading for San Bernardino, San Berdu, his aunt called it, and all he could think was this trip would be over soon. Please, God, let it be over before he killed the bird. But Stan was exhausted, and after driving more than 2,000 miles, he had become strangely disoriented. Either he had missed the San Berdu turnoff, or he wasn't sure. He was lost. And the bird still shrieked. Your heart sweats, your body shakes, another kiss is what it takes. He pulled the car over. He opened the door to the back seat. He took the cloth off. Gerard, he said, why are you doing this? You can't sleep. You can't eat. Gerard, stop it! Why?
I'm afraid.
Why?
It's too far from home. The bird blinked, looked at the darkness outside. What fresh hell is this?
This is the desert.
It's freezing.
The desert is cold at night.
Why are we here?
I'm taking you to your new home.
Stan stared at the bird.
If I leave your cloth off, will you be quiet?
Yes. No talking at all?
Yes. You promise?
Yes.
Okay. I need it quiet so I can find out where we are. I don't know why I love you like I do after all the changes.
Try and help me, Gerard. Please.
Stan went around and got in the driver's seat. He pulled out onto the road and started driving. The bird was quiet. The miles rolled by. Then he saw a sign for a town called Erp, 3 miles ahead.
Mellow greetings, Yuki Dookie,
Gerard said. Stan sighed. He drove forward into the night.
You remind me of a man, Gerard said.
You promised, Stan said.
No, you are supposed to say, what man?
Gerard, shut up.
You remind me of a man, Gerard said.
What man?
The man with the power.
What power?
The power of hoodoo.
Hoodoo? Stan said.
You do.
Do what?
Remind me of a man.
What man? Stan said, and then he caught himself.
Gerard, shut up, or I will put you outside right now.
Ooh, aren't you the twisted bunny? Stan glanced at his watch. 1 more hour, he thought. 1 more hour, and that bird was out.
Ellis sat down across from his brother Aaron in Aaron's office at the law firm. The office window looked south over the city, down toward the Empire State Building. It was a hazy day, but the view was still spectacular, powerful.
Okay, Ellis said. I talked to that guy in California, Josh Winkler.
Uh-huh.
He says he never gave anything to Mom.
Uh-huh.
Says what he sent was water.
Well, that's what you would expect him to say.
Aaron, Ellis said. They gave her water.
Winkler said that he was not going to transport anything across state lines. His mother wanted it done, so he sent water to test the placebo effect.
And you believe him? Aaron said, shaking his head.
I think he has documentation.
Of course he does, Aaron said.
Sign-outs, lab reports, and other documentation maintained by his company.
Falsified, Aaron said.
That documentation is required by the FDA. Falsifying it is a federal offense.
So is giving gene therapy to friends.
Aaron pulled out a sheaf of papers.
Do you know the history of gene therapy? It's a horror story, Ellie. Starting back in the late 1980s, the biotech guys went off half-cocked and killed people right and left. At least 600 people we know about have been killed, and plenty more we don't know about. You know why we don't know? No. Why? Because they claimed, get this, that the deaths couldn't be reported because they were proprietary information. Killing their patients was a trade secret.
Did they really say that?
Could I make this shit up? And then they bill Medicare for the cost of the experiment that killed the patient. They kill, we pay. And if the universities get caught, they claim they don't have to give informed consent to subjects because they are non-profit institutions. Duke, Penn, University of Minnesota, big places have been caught. Academics think they're above the law. 600 deaths,
Ellis said.
I don't see what this has to do. You know how gene therapy kills people? All sorts of ways. They don't know what's going to happen. They insert genes into people, and it turns on cancer genes, and the people die of cancer. Or they have huge allergic reactions and die. These goofballs don't know what the hell they are doing. They're reckless, and they don't follow the rules. And we, he said, are gonna smack their asses down.
Ellis squirmed in his chair. But what if Winkler's telling the truth? What if we are wrong?
We didn't break the rules, Aaron said. They did. Now Mom's got Alzheimer's, and they're in deep, deep shit.
When Brad Gordon started the bar fight at the Lucky Lucy Saloon on Pearl Street in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, he hadn't intended to end up in the hospital. The two guys in the tight-fitting plaid shirts with the pointy pearl-button pockets looked like pussies to him, and he figured he could take them easily. There was no way to know they were brothers, not lovers, and they didn't take kindly to his remarks about them. And there was no way to know that the smaller one taught karate at Wyoming State and had won some kind of championship at a Bruce Lee tournament for martial arts in Hong Kong. Kickboxing with metal-tipped cowboy boots. Brad lasted all of 30 seconds, and a lot of his teeth were loose. He had been lying in this fucking infirmary for 3 hours while they tried to push the teeth back in place. There was one periodontist they kept calling, but he wasn't answering, possibly because, as the intern explained, he was off hunting for the weekend because he liked elk. Tasty eating. Elk. Brad's fucking mouth was killing him. So they left him there with ice packs on his face and his jaw shot full of Novocaine, and somehow he fell asleep, and the next morning the swelling had gone down enough that he could talk on the phone. So he called his attorney, Willie Johnson, in Los Angeles, holding the business card between his bruised thumb and forefinger. The receptionist was cheerful.
Johnson, Baker, and Halloran.
Willie Johnson, please.
Hold on, please.
The phone clicked, but he wasn't put on hold, and then he heard the woman say,
Faber, Ellis, and Condon.
Brad looked again at the card in his hand. The address was an office building in Encino. He knew what that place was. It was a building where solo attorneys could rent a tiny office and share a receptionist who was trained to answer the phone as if she was working at a big law firm, so clients would not suspect their attorneys were on their own. That building housed only the most unsuccessful sort of attorney, the ones who handled small-time drug dealers or who had done jail time themselves.
"Excuse me," he said into the phone.
"Sorry, sir. I'm trying to find Mr. Johnson for you." She cupped her hand over the phone. "Anybody seen Willie Johnson?"
And he heard a muffled voice yell back, "Willie Johnson is a dick." Sitting there at the entrance to the emergency room, weak and in pain, his jaw aching like hell, Brad did not feel good about what he was hearing.
"Did you find Mr. Johnson?"
"One moment, sir. We're looking..."
He hung up. He felt like crying. He went out to get breakfast, but it hurt too much to eat, and people in the coffee shop looked at him oddly. He saw his reflection in the glass and realized his whole jaw was blue and puffy.
Still, it was better than last night. He wasn't worried about anything except this attorney, Johnson. All his initial suspicions about the man were confirmed. Why had they met at a restaurant instead of his law firm? Because Johnson didn't belong to a law firm. There was nothing to do but call his uncle Jack.
John B. Watson Investment Group.
Mr. Watson, please. They put him through to the secretary, who put him through to his uncle. Hey, Uncle Jack.
Where the fuck are you?
Watson said. He sounded distinctly unfriendly.
I'm in Wyoming.
Staying out of trouble, I hope.
Actually, my attorney sent me here, he said. And that's why I'm calling you. I'm a little worried. I mean, this guy...
Look, Watson said, you're up on a molestation charge, and you've got a molestation expert to handle your case. You don't have to like him. Personally, I hear he's a prick.
Well,
but he wins cases. Do what he says. Why are you talking funny?
Nothing.
I'm busy, Brad, and you were told never to call. Click.
Brad was feeling worse than ever. Back at his motel room, the guy at the desk said someone from the police had come looking for him. Something about a hate crime. Brad decided it was time to leave beautiful Jackson Hole. He went to his room to pack, watching some true crime show where the police caught a dangerous fugitive by pretending to put him on television. They staged a fake TV interview set up, and as soon as the guy relaxed, they slapped cuffs on him. And now the guy was on death row. Police were getting tricky. Brad hastily finished packing, paid his bill, and hurried out to his car. The self-proclaimed environmental artist, Mark Sanger, recently returned from a trip to Costa Rica, looked up from his computer in astonishment as four men broke down the door and burst into his Berkeley apartment. The men were dressed head to foot in blue rubber hazmat suits, with big rubber helmets and big faceplates, rubber gloves and boots, and they carried evil-looking rifles and big pistols. He had hardly reacted to the shock when they were on him, grabbing him with their rubber hands and wrestling him away from the keyboard. "Pigs! Fascists!" Sanger yelled. But suddenly it seemed like everybody was shouting and screaming in the room. "This is an outrage, fascist pigs!" he shouted as they cuffed him. But he could see their faces behind the masks, and they were afraid. "Jesus! What do you think I'm doing here?" he said, and one of them answered, "We know what you're doing, Mr. Sanger," and spun him away.
"Hey! Hey!"
They pulled him roughly down the steps from his apartment to the street. Sanger could only hope media would be waiting, cameras ready to film this outrage in broad daylight. The press, however, was cordoned off across the street. They could hear Sanger as he shouted, and they were filming him, but their distance prevented the up-close, in-your-face confrontation he hoped for. In fact, Sanger suddenly realized how this scene must look through their lenses. Policemen dressed in frightening hazmat suits escorting a 30-ish bearded man in jeans and a Che Guevara t-shirt who struggled in their arms, cursing and shouting. Sanger knew he must look like a madman, like one of the Teds, Ted Bundy, Ted Kaczynski, one of those guys. The cops would say that he had microbiology equipment in his apartment, that he had tools for genetic engineering, and he was making a plague, making a virus, making a disease, something horrible, a madman. "Put me down," he said, forcing himself to be calm. "I can walk. Let me walk." "All right, sir," one of them said. They let him stand on his feet and walk. Sanger walked with as much dignity as he could muster, straightening his shoulders, shaking his long hair as they led him to a waiting car. Of course, it was an unmarked car. He should have expected that. Fucking FBI or CIA or whatever.
secret government organizations, the shadow government, black helicopters, unaccountable, the crypto-Nazis among us. Fuming, he wasn't prepared to see Mrs. Maloof, the black lady who lived on the second floor of his building, standing outside with her two young kids. As he passed her, she leaned forward and started yelling at him. "You bastard! You risk my family? You risk my children's lives? You Frankenstein! Frankenstein!" Sanger was intensely aware of how that moment would play on the evening news. A black mother shouts at him, calls him Frankenstein, and the kids at her side were crying, frightened by everything that was happening around them. Then the cop shoved Sanger into the unmarked car, with one rubber-gloved hand on his head, easing him into the back seat. And as the door slammed shut, he thought, "I am fucking screwed." Sitting in his jail cell, watching the television in the hallway, trying to hear the commentary over the arguments of the other guys in the cell, trying to ignore the faint smell of vomit and the deep sense of despair that settled over him as he watched. First, there was footage of Sanger himself, hair long, dressed like a bum, walking between two guys in hazmat suits. He looked even worse than he had feared. The corporate flunky reading the news was mouthing all the buzzwords. Sanger was unemployed. He was an uneducated drifter. He was a fanatic and a loner who had genetic engineering materials in his cramped, filthy apartment, and he was considered dangerous because he fit the classic bioterrorist profile. Next, a bearded San Francisco lawyer from some environmental defense group said Sanger should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. Sanger had caused irreparable harm to an endangered species and had jeopardized the very existence of the species by his depredations. Sanger frowned. What the hell was he talking about? Next, the TV showed a picture of a leatherback turtle and a map of Costa Rica. Now it seemed that authorities had been alerted to Sanger's activities because he had visited Tortuguero on the Atlantic coast of Costa Rica sometime before, and because he had made serious threats to the environment regarding leatherback turtles. Sanger couldn't follow this. He had never made any threats. He had wanted to help, that was all. And the fact was, once he got back to his apartment, he had been unable to carry out his plans. He bought stacks of genetics textbooks, but the whole thing was much too complicated. He opened the shortest of the texts and scanned some of the captions to graphics. A plasmid harboring a normal LOXP has little chance of remaining integrated in a genome at a similar LOXP site, since the CRE recombinase will eliminate the integrated DNA fragment. Lentiviral vectors injected into one-cell embryos or incubated with embryos from which Zona pellucida was withdrawn were particularly... A more efficient way to replace a gene relies on the use of mutant ES cells devoid of the HPRT gene, hypoxanthine phosphoribosyl transferase. These cells cannot survive in the HAT medium, which contains hypoxanthine, aminoterine, and thymidine. The HPRT gene is introduced at the targeted site by a double homologous recombination. Sanger had stopped reading. And now the TV screen showed turtles on the beach at night glowing a weird purple color. And they thought that he had done that? The very idea was ridiculous. But a fascist state demanded blood for any transgression, real or imagined. Sanger could foresee himself thrown in jail for a crime he hadn't committed. a crime that he didn't even know how to commit.
New transgenic pets on horizon. Giant cockroaches. Permanent pups. Artists, industry, hard at work. Yale-trained artist Lisa Hensley has joined forces with the genetic firm of Borger and Snod Limited to create giant cockroaches to be sold as pets. The GM cockroaches will be 3 feet long and stand approximately 1 foot off the ground. They will be the size of large dachshunds, says Hensley. Although, of course, they won't bark. Hensley regards the pets as works of art intended to raise human awareness of the insect community. The overwhelming majority of living matter on our planet consists of insects, she said. Yet we maintain an irrational prejudice against them. We should embrace our insect brethren, kiss them, love them. She observed that the real danger of global warming is that we may render so many insects extinct. Hensley acknowledged that she was inspired by the work of artist Catherine Chalmers, BS Engineering, Stanford University, whose project, American Cockroach, first elevated cockroaches to a major theme of contemporary art. Meanwhile, in suburban New Jersey, the firm of Cumnick Genomics is hard at work creating an animal they believe dog owners really want. Permanent puppies. Cumnick's perma puppies will never grow up, according to spokesperson Lynn Cumnick. When you buy a perma puppy, it stays a puppy forever. The firm is working to eliminate unwanted puppy behavior, such as chewing shoes, which gets on dog owners' nerves. Once the teeth are in, this behavior stops, Cumnick said. Unfortunately, at this point, our genetic interventions have prevented the growth of teeth altogether, but we'll solve that. She said that rumors they were going to market a toothless animal called a gummy dog were untrue. Cumnick observes that since adulthood in human beings is being replaced by permanent adolescence, people naturally wish to be accompanied through life by similarly youthful dogs. Like Peter Pan, we never want to grow up, she says. Genetics makes it possible.
Still lost, now driving through very hilly terrain, Stan Milgram squinted at the road sign emerging from the darkness ahead. Palomar Mountain, 37 miles, where the hell was that? He had never realized California was so big. He had passed through a couple of towns a ways back, but at 3 in the morning everything was closed, including gas stations, and then he was once more in dark, empty countryside. He should have brought a map. Stan was exhausted, irritable, and he needed to pull over and sleep. But the damn bird would start shrieking as soon as he stopped the car. Gerard had been silent for the last hour, but now, inexplicably, he began to make telephone dial tones, as if he were calling someone. "Stop it, Gerard," Stan said, and the bird stopped. At least for a moment, Stan was able to drive in silence. But, of course, it didn't last.
"I'm hungry," Gerard said. "You and me both." "You bring any chips?"
"The chips are gone." They had eaten the last of them back in the town of Erp an hour ago, 2 hours ago. "Nobody knows the trouble I've seen," Gerard said, humming. "Don't do it," Stan warned. "Nobody knows except Jesus." "Gerard." Silence. It was like traveling with a child, Stan thought. The bird had all of the stubbornness and unexpectedness of a child. It was exhausting. They passed train tracks off to the right. Gerard made chugging sounds and a mournful whistle.
"I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when."
Stan decided not to say anything. He gripped the wheel and drove through the night. Behind him, he could see a faint lightening of the sky.
That meant he was driving west, and that was where he wanted to go, more or less. And then in the tense silence, Gerard began again.
"Ladies and gentlemen, mesdames et messieurs, damen und herren, from what was once an inarticulate mass of lifeless tissues, may I now present a cultured, sophisticated man about town. Hit it!"
"You're pushing," Stan said, "and I'm giving you a warning."
"It's my life! Don't you forget!"
the bird sang, screaming at the top of its lungs. It seemed as if the whole car vibrated. Stan thought the windows might shatter. He winced, gripped the wheel harder, and then the screaming stopped.
"We're so glad to see so many of you lovely people here tonight," Gerard said, sounding like an announcer. Stan shook his head. "Dear God. Let's be happy. Happy, happy. Say the word now. Happy, happy, happy. Try it somehow."
"Stop," Stan said. Gerard went right on.
"Happy, happy, happy, happy. Oh, baby, yes. Happy, happy."
"That's it," Stan yelled, pulling over to the side of the road. He got out of the car, slammed the driver's door hard.
"You don't scare me, Buster," Gerard said.
Stan swore and opened the back door. Gerard was singing again. "I've got some news for you, and you'll soon find out it's true, and you'll have to eat your lunch all by yourself."
"No problem,"
Stan said, "because you are out of here, pal." He grabbed the bird roughly. Gerard pecked at him viciously, but he didn't care, and put Gerard down on the side of the road in the dust.
"It looks as though you're letting go, and if it's real, I don't want to..."
"It's real," Stan snarled. Gerard flapped his wings.
"You can't do this to me," he said.
"Oh, no. Watch me." Stan walked back to the front of the car, opened the door.
"I want my perch," Gerard said. "It's the least you can..."
"Fuck your damn perch!"
"Don't go away mad. It can't be so bad. Don't go away."
"Bye-bye, Gerard."
Stan slammed the door and shoved his foot down on the pedal, driving off fast, making sure he raised a big cloud of dust. He looked back, but couldn't see the bird. He did, however, see all the bird shit in the back seat. Jeez, it would take days to clean all that up. But now it was quiet. Blessedly quiet. Finally, the adventures of Gerard were over. Now that there was silence in the car, his accumulated fatigue hit him. Stan began to doze off. He turned on the radio, rolled down the window, stuck his head out in the cold breeze. Nothing was helping. He realized he was going to fall asleep, and he had to pull off the road. That bird had kept him awake. He felt a little bad putting him out in the road that way. It was as good as killing him. A bird like that wouldn't last long in the desert. Some rattler or coyote would make quick work of him, had probably already done it. No reason to go back. Stan pulled over to the side of the road into a grove of pines. He turned the engine off and inhaled the scent of the trees. He fell instantly asleep. Gerard walked back and forth on the dusty ground for a while in the darkness. Apparently, he wanted to get off the ground because several times he tried jumping onto the scrubby sage bushes that surrounded him, but the sage didn't support his weight, and he came crashing down again each time. Finally, he half-hopped, half-flew into the air, coming down again on a juniper bush about 3 feet off the ground. Standing on that makeshift perch, he might have gone to sleep, except the temperature was extremely cold for a tropical bird, and he was kept awake by the yelping of a pack of animals in the desert. The yelps were coming closer. Gerard ruffled his feathers, a sign of unease. He looked in the direction of the sound. he saw several dark shapes moving through the desert brush. He caught the glint of green eyes. He ruffled his feathers again and watched the pack come toward him. The Robinson R-44 helicopter descended in a cloud of dust, and Vasco Borden came out, crouched beneath the blades. He got into the waiting black Hummer.
"Talk to me," he said to Dolly, who was driving.
She'd come down earlier, while Vasco went on that wild goose chase to Pebble Beach. Dolly said, "She checked into the Best Western at 7:30 tonight, went to Walston's, where a security guy ID'd the car. She brushed him off with a story about an ex-husband, and he went for it."
"When was that?"
"Little before 8. From there, she went back to the motel, gave the kid at the desk a story about someone being in her room. While he was checking, she took his shotgun from under the counter and made off with it."
"Did she?" Borden said. "The little lady has some balls."
"Apparently, she had tried to buy a gun in a drugstore, but ran into the 10-day wait."
"And now?"
"We were tracking her cell phone, but she turned it off. Before that happened, we got her heading east toward Ortega Highway."
"Into the desert," Vasco said, nodding. "She'll sleep in her car and then continue on tomorrow morning."
"We can download sat shots at 8 a.m. That's the fastest processing time."
"She'll be gone before 8 in the morning,"
Vasco said. He leaned back in the Hummer.
"She'll go at dawn. So let's see."
He paused, thinking.
"All afternoon she's been driving, and it's basically south. The minute all this began, our lady went south."
"You thinking Mexico?" Dolly said. Vasco shook his head.
"She doesn't want to leave a record, and crossing the border will leave a record."
"Maybe she'll head east, try to cross at Brown Field or Calexico," Dolly said.
"Maybe."
Vasco rubbed his beard thoughtfully. Too late, he felt the mascara coming off on his fingers. Damn, he had to remember that.
"She's scared. I think she's heading for a place she thinks will give her help. Maybe meet her father down here. Or meet up with somebody she knows. An old boyfriend, school friend, sorority sister, former teacher, former law partner, something like that."
"We've been checking all the net databases for the last 2 hours," Dolly said, "and so far we've got nothing."
"How about our old phone records?"
"No calls to San Diego area code."
"How far back?"
"A year. That's all that's available without a special order."
"So whoever this is, she hasn't called him in a year."
Vasco sighed. "We'll just have to wait for her." He turned to Dolly.
"Let's go to that Best Western. I want to find out what kind of gun the little lady got. And we can get a couple of hours rest before dawn. I'm sure we'll get her by tomorrow. I got a feeling."
He tapped his chest.
"And I'm never wrong."
"Hun, you just got mascara on your nice shirt."
"Ah, hell," he sighed.
"It'll come out," Dolly said. "I'll get it out for you." Gerard watched the dark shapes approach. They moved with a loping gait and made a snorting or snuffling sound and sometimes a mewling sound. Their bodies were low. Their backs were just visible above the sage. They circled his perch, approaching, then sliding away. But they had clearly smelled him because they were coming ever closer to him. There were 6 animals altogether. Gerard ruffled his feathers, partly in an attempt to warm his body. The animals had long snouts. Their eyes glowed bright green. They had a distinctive musky odor that was unpleasant. They had long, fluffy tails. He could see that they were not black, but rather brownish-gray in color. They moved in closer. "I'm shaken. I'm shaken now." And closer. They were quite close now. The largest one paused a few feet away and stared at Gerard. Gerard did not move. After several seconds, the big animal edged closer.
"You can stop right there, mister!"
The animal stopped instantly
and even took a few paces backward. The other animals in the group backed away, too. They all seemed confused by the voice. But not for long. The big animal started to move in again.
"Well, hold on!"
This time there was only a momentary pause. Then the animal kept coming.
"You feel lucky, punk? Do you? Huh?"
The animal was coming very slowly now, sniffing at Gerard, closer and closer. Sniff, sniff. The creature smelled awful. The nose was just inches away. Gerard bent and bit hard on the animal's soft nose. The creature yelped and jumped backward, almost knocking Gerard from his perch. He regained his balance.
"Every time you turn around, expect to see me," Gerard said, "'cause one time you'll turn around, and I'll be there, and I'll kill you, Matt."
The animal was flat on the ground, rubbing his injured nose with his forelegs. He did that for a while. Then he got up, growling.
"Life is hard, but it's harder if you're stupid."
The whole pack of animals was growling now. They moved forward in a semicircle. They seemed to be coordinated. Gerard ruffled his feathers and ruffled them again. He even flapped his wings, trying to make as large and active a shape of himself as possible. These creatures didn't seem to care.
"Look, you fools, you're in danger, can't you see? They're after you. They're after all of us."
But the spoken voices seemed to have no effect at all. The animals just kept moving forward slowly. One was loping around behind Gerard. He turned his head to look. Not good. Not good.
"Get back to where you once belonged."
Gerard flapped his wings again, nervously, but apparently the anxiety gave him new strength, because there was a bit of lift from the branch he stood on. The growling animals closed in. And Gerard flapped his wings hard, hard, and felt himself lift into the air. It was weeks since his last feather clip. That was the reason. He could fly. He moved high above the ground and discovered that he could soar a little. Not much, but a little. The smelly animals were far below, howling at him. But Gerard turned west, following the road that Stan had been driving on. He was heading away from the sunrise toward darkness. With his acute sense of smell, he detected the odor of food and flew toward that. Sleeping in the front seat of her car, Alex Burnett opened her eyes and saw that she was surrounded by men. Three of them were peering into her car. They wore cowboy hats and carried big pronged sticks with loops on them. She sat up abruptly. One of them waved for her to be still.
"Just a moment, miss."
Alex looked over at her son, Jamie, sleeping peacefully in the seat beside her. He didn't awaken. Nothing woke Jamie. When she looked back outside, she gasped. One of the cowboys raised his stick, a gigantic rattlesnake, easily 5 feet long and as thick as a forearm, was wriggling on the end of it, making a sizzling sound with its rattle.
"You can come out now, if you want."
He swung the snake away. She opened the door cautiously.
"It's the heat of your engine," one of them said. "Draws 'em under the car in the mornings."
She saw that there were 6 men altogether. They each had sticks and carried large sacks with squirming contents.
"What are you doing?"
"We're collecting rattlers."
"Why?"
she said. "For the rattlesnake roundup next week in Yuma."
"Uh-huh."
"Do it every year. It's a contest. Who brings the most snakes?"
"I see."
"It's by weight, so you want the biggins. Didn't mean to frighten you."
"Thank you."
The group of men was moving off. The man talking to her lagged behind.
"Ma'am, you oughtn't to be out here alone," he said, "though I see you got yourself a weapon."
He nodded to the back seat of the car.
"Yes," she said, "but I don't have any ammo."
"Well, that won't do you," the man said. He started toward his car, parked across the road. Is that a 12-gauge you got?
Yes, it is.
These'll serve.
He gave her a handful of red shells. She stuffed them into her pockets.
Thanks. What do I owe you?
He shook his head.
You just take care, ma'am.
He turned to rejoin the others. A black Hummer came up this road about an hour ago. Big guy with a beard. Said he was looking for a woman and her little boy. Said he was their uncle and they were missing.
Uh-huh. What'd you tell him?
We hadn't seen you yet, so we said no.
Which way did he go? She said.
Toward Elsinore. But I figure any time now he'll be heading back.
Thanks, she said.
He waved. Don't stop for gas, he said. And good luck.
Transcript, CBS 5, San Francisco.
Accused bioterrorist released today.
CBS 5.
Suspected terrorist Mark Sanger was released from Alameda County Jail today on 2 years probation for possession of dangerous biological materials. Informed sources say the technical complexity of the government's charges against Sanger led the prosecutors to reluctantly conclude that they might not be able to put the suspect behind bars. In particular, the charge against Sanger that he had genetically modified turtles in Central America has now been thrown into question. We spoke with Julio Menares in Costa Rica.
It is true that the Atlantic turtles have suffered from genetic modification that produces a purple color in their shells. As yet, there is no explanation for how this happened. But the age of the turtles indicates that genetic manipulation occurred 5 to 10 years ago.
Shortly after his arrest, investigators determined that Sanger had not been in Costa Rica early enough to have carried out the genetic change. He was only there last year. And so Mark Sanger, suspected terrorist, is now free on a $500 fine.
In Congressional Hearing Room 443, while waiting for proceedings to begin, Congressman Marvin Minkowski, Democrat Wisconsin, turned to Congressman Henry Wexler, Democrat California, and said,
"Shouldn't we have stronger regulations to limit the availability of recombinant DNA technology?"
"You thinking of Sanger?"
"Well, he's the most recent case. Where did he get his stuff, do you know?"
"On the Internet," Wexler said.
"You can buy recombinant kits from outfits in New Jersey and North Carolina. Cost a couple of $100.
"That's asking for trouble, isn't it?"
"Listen," Wexler said, "my wife gardens."
"Does your wife garden?"
"Now that the kids are gone, she's a fanatic about her roses."
"Local garden club, all of that?"
"Well, sure."
"Plenty of gardeners who used to make hybrids by grafting cuttings onto rootstocks now use DNA kits to carry things a step further," Wexler said. "People are making genetically modified roses all over the world. Supposedly a Japanese company has made a blue rose using GM methods. A blue rose has been a dream of growers for centuries. Point is, the technology's everywhere, Marv. It's in big companies, and it's in backyards everywhere."
"What do we do about that?" Minkowski said.
"Nothing," Wexler said. "I'm not about to do anything to make your wife angry, or mine."
He cupped his chin in his hand, in a gesture that always looked intelligent on camera.
"But maybe," he said, "maybe it's time for a speech expressing my concern about the dangers of this uncontrolled technology."
"Good idea," Minkowski said. "I think I'll give one, too."
Liposuction news. Prime Minister's fat sells for $18,000. Next, celebrities to donate fat for charity. BBC News. A bar of soap made from fat liposuction from Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has been sold for $18,000 to a private collector. The soap is a work of art entitled Mani Puliti, Clean Hands, made by the artist Gianni Motti, who is based in Switzerland. Marty bought the fat from a clinic in Lugano where Berlusconi had the liposuction performed. Marty then molded it into a bar of soap, which sold at the Basel Art Fair to a private Swiss collector who can now wash his hands with Berlusconi. Commentators noted that Berlusconi is unpopular in Europe, which may have reduced the price fetched by his fat. The fat of film celebrities would be worth significantly more. The sky's the limit for Brad Pitt or Pamela Anderson byproducts, said one. Would celebrities ever sell their fat? Why not, said a Beverly Hills plastic surgeon. It could be a charity thing. After all, they're doing the liposuction anyway. At the moment, we just throw the fat away. But they might as well use their fat to help worthy causes. Speedboat racer bums around, the butt of many jokes. Wired News Service. Wealthy New Zealander Peter Bethune will attempt to set a world record on a speedboat powered by fat from his own backside. His eco-correct 78-foot trimaran, Earth Race, is powered entirely by biodiesel fuel made from vegetable oil and other fats. In fact, Bethune's bum will make only a minor contribution to the round-the-world journey. His buttocks yielded a mere liter of fuel. However, Bethune noted that he was badly bruised and said it was a personal sacrifice to produce the fuel. Artist cooks, eats his own body fat, protests wastefulness of Western society. Reuters. New York conceptual artist Ricardo Vega underwent liposuction, cooked his fat, and ate it. He said his purpose was to draw attention to the wastefulness of Western society. He also set aside other portions of his fat for sale, noting that this would enable people to taste human flesh and experience cannibalism. Vega did not set a price for his fat, but one art dealer estimated that it would be worth considerably less than Berlusconi's. Berlusconi is a prime minister, he pointed out. Vega is an unknown. Besides, this is already being done by the artist Marcos Evarista, who made meatballs of his body fat. Marcos Evarista is a Chilean-born artist living in Denmark. Reports that his body fat meatballs would be auctioned by Christie's in New York could not be confirmed, as Christie's representatives did not return phone calls. The ambulance sped south on the freeway. Sitting in the driver's seat, wearing her new Bluetooth headset, Dolly talked to Vasco. Vasco was angry, but there was nothing Dolly could do about it. He'd set off in the wrong direction a second time. He had only himself to blame. "Look," Dolly said, "we just got telephone records for the last 5 years, just got 'em this minute. Alex calls people in this area code named Kendall, Henry, and Lynn. He's a biochemist. We don't know what she does, but Lynn and Alex are the same age. We think maybe they grew up together." "And where are they located?" Vasco said. "The Kendalls." "La Jolla? It's north of..." "I know where it is, goddammit," Vasco said. "Where are you now?" Dolly said. "Coming back from Elsinore. I'm at least an hour from La Jolla. Road's so damn twisty. God damn it, I know she was sleeping on this road somewhere."
"How do you know?" "I just know. Got my nose working."
"Okay, well, she's probably on her way to La Jolla now. She might even be there already."
"And where are you?"
20 minutes from the Kendall house. You want us to pick them up?"
Vasco said. "How's the doc?"
"Sober."
"Sure."
"Close enough for government work," Dolly said. "He's drinking coffee from a thermos."
"You check the thermos?"
"Yes, of course. So, do we pick up or wait for you?"
"If it's the girl, Alex, leave her alone. But if you see the kid, grab him."
"We'll do,"
Dolly said.
"Bob," Alex said, holding her phone to her ear. She heard a groan at the other end.
"What time is it?"
"It's 7 in the morning, Bob."
"Oh, Christ.
a thump as his head hit the pillow.
This better be important, Alex.
Were you out on a wine tasting? Robert A. Koch, distinguished head of the law firm, devoted a great deal of attention to wine, kept his collection in lockers all over town, bought at auction from Christie's, made trips to Napa, Australia, France. But as far as Alex was concerned, the whole thing was just an excuse to get drunk on a regular basis.
I'm waiting, Alex, he said. It better be good.
Okay. Last 24 hours, I got a bounty hunter. Huge guy, looks like a walking brick. He's after me and my kid, trying to stick biopsy needles in us and take our cells.
Very funny. I'm waiting.
I'm serious, Bob. There's a bounty hunter chasing me and my kid.
This is out of nowhere?
No. I think it's related to Biogen.
I hear Biogen is having troubles, Bob said. And they're trying to take your cells. They probably can't do that.
Probably is not what I want to hear.
You know the law is unclear.
Look, she said, I have my 8-year-old son here. They're trying to grab him in the back of an ambulance and stick needles into his liver. I don't want to hear unclear. I want to hear we'll stop it.
We'll certainly try, he said. This is your father's case?
Yeah.
Did you call him?
He's not answering.
You call the police?
There's a warrant out for my arrest in Oxnard. There's a hearing in Oxnard today. I need somebody good to go up and appear for me.
I'll send Dennis.
I said somebody good.
Dennis is good?
Dennis is good if he has a month. This is today, Bob.
Well, who do you want?
I want you, she said.
Oh, Christ. Oxnard? It's so fucking far. I haven't had my shots.
I have a sawed-off shotgun in the back seat, Bob. I don't really care if you think the drive is too long.
Okay. Okay, take it easy, he said. I have to arrange some things.
Will you go?
Yes, I'll go. You want to give me a hint what this is about?
You'll find it in the Burnett file. I assume it has to do with takings by eminent domain or simple conversion.
Taking your cells?
They claim they own them.
How can they own your cells? They own your father's cells.
Oh, I get it. Same cells. But that's bullshit, Alex. Tell the judge.
They can't violate the integrity of your body or the body of your kid. Just
save it for the judge, she said. I'll call you later, find out how it went. She flipped the phone shut. She looked down at Jamie. He was still sleeping, peaceful as an angel. If Koch got to Oxnard by late morning, he might get an emergency hearing set for the afternoon. She should probably call him around 4 p.m. That seemed a very long time away. She drove toward La Jolla.
It's the last thing we need, Henry Kendall thought. Visitors.
He watched in dismay as Lynn threw her arms around Alex Burnett and then bent over to hug Alex's kid, Jamie. Alex and Jamie had just shown up, with no advance warning. The women were chattering excitedly, arms fluttering, happy to see each other as they walked into the kitchen to get food for Alex's Jamie. Meanwhile, his son Jamie and Dave were playing Drive or Die on the PlayStation. The sound of crunching metal and squealing tires filled the room.